For more information, visit futurebased.org.
Hi, and welcome everyone to the Future-Based X Inverse Surveillance AI podcast series. My name is Abdurrahman Hassan, and I am the host of the series. I'm a data science practitioner and educator, particularly interested in the intersection between technology and critical theory. Inverse Surveillance AI is a project of the Asimov Institute, funded by the SIDN Fund. The project is a think tank of scientists, policymakers, and philosophers gathered to answer the question, how can we use AI as a panopticon to promote beneficial actions for citizens by organization? Based on this insights produced from this think tank, a first proof of concept will be developed in a hackathon. The project lasts around 6 months and operates from a utopian and solution-oriented approach. The main goal is to deepen the subject of inverse surveillance to explore how AI can make this possible. Meanwhile, sharing all information so that it can function as a launchpad for future research. In this podcast series, together with the Asimov director, Stefan Leinen, we go into conversations with experts in the field of AI technology. But before we jump into our first guest, I want to introduce Stefan Leinen. Dr. Stefan is a professor of Artificial Intelligence Research Group at the Utrecht University of Applied Sciences. Stefan is a director of the Asimov Institute, where it publishes fundamental breakthroughs in neural network research, advises on social business impacts of data and AI, and builds tools for the creative industry, architects, graphic designers, fashion couturiers, marketeers, and music producers. Welcome, Stefan. Really happy you could join us today. Today, we actually would like to gain a deeper understanding of surveillance in general, surveillance in particular, from a more philosophical lens. This is why we are joined here today with Aidan Leon. Aidan completed his PhD in 2010 at the Australian National University on the philosophical foundations of probability. His research focuses on psychedelics, meditation, uncertainty, wisdom, and collective decision making. Aidan's also an entrepreneur. He's CEO and co-founder of Delphi Cloud and often works as a freelancer consultant on projects relating to many research areas. His new book, Psychedelic Experience, is a philosophical analysis of psychedelic experience with central thesis that psychedelic experiences are mind-revealing experiences and can actually occur via meditation. Incredibly happy to be here with Aidan and to talk with him about the concept of surveillance, that is, when the process of surveillance is subverted and the watching happens from below rather than from above. I would like to have a conversation about not only the nature of surveillance, but also ways in which we can proliferate it to create an ideal situation between those surveilling and those being surveyed. First, I would like to ask Aidan the link between awareness and surveillance. How can one be productively aware of the state of being watched?
Thank you. And thanks for having me. It's really fun to be here. Yeah, I was thinking about this question a little bit. I really like this way of approaching this topic. We're using this utopian thinking. So it's oftentimes, it's very easy to think of surveillance in this sort of dystopian framework, all the ways that it could go wrong. And so thinking about it from that utopian perspective of like, how could we have a sort of a better and ideal world where there's surveillance? It got me thinking about this relationship between awareness and surveillance. I think a lot of people have a natural aversion to surveillance. And a lot of that comes from a healthy skepticism about the government and large organizations. But there's another reason there, which is often gets kind of neglected, or we overlook it because of that larger kind of dystopian worry. And that is, I think we're sometimes a little bit worried about ourselves. We don't trust ourselves. What's going to be exposed when we're under surveillance, right? So we're not always sure that we are always doing the right thing, or we are honest, or that we're qualified enough. You see this with imposter syndrome all the time. And so we're worried that these things will be exposed when we're under surveillance. And so there's a kind of a positive angle here, which is, again, from this utopian perspective, obviously the dystopian concerns are real and shouldn't be ignored. But can we kind of organize our psychology so that we're comfortable with surveillance, right? And that is going to involve looking inwards and being comfortable with who we are, being being authentic, like making sure that we're getting involved in social relations and organizations. And so I thought this was a pretty cool thing where surveillance could actually be almost like a tool of personal growth.
Wow, that is actually quite fascinating. Also, as an angle to look or rethink surveillance as something that we often engage with anyway, and also to kind of adopt this mentality. And I feel also Stefan can jump in here because also he thought of this kind of framework to adopt in the project. But I'm interested in kind of the different ways in which we are already engaging with surveillance from kind of this non-dystopian perspective. So what is kind of a helpful or common type of surveillance that we're engaging with?
I think there's one obvious example, actually, there might be two. One is the media in general, where in essence, journalists are given the task to survey very often organizations or people within organizations at certain positions for the good of society. A second example that comes to mind is the mechanism of democracy, which is, I think it even goes beyond surveillance in the sense that it's not just about information, but it actually captures a power relation where democracy represents a power relation of a group of people over an organization or a powerful person in this case. And I think both media and democracy can be perceived as utopian or idealistic, at least not dystopian, ways of working with surveillance or surveillance-like mechanisms.
Awesome. So I think we've already touched upon kind of the next point of inquiry, because we see we can change the dynamic of surveillance a little bit based on who is doing the watching. So the distinction that surveillance makes is that you have surveillance is someone watching from above. There's an implied power relationship in this case. Surveillance reverses this kind of dynamic, is that people at the bottom are watching something that is kind of more in power. So I want to think, based on this utopian dystopian thinking, if we're enacting this bottom-up framework to watching surveillance, can surveillance actually be counterproductive?
I mean, we've had some quite famous cases of it being counterproductive. One example that comes to mind was the Boston bombing that happened. Everyone was, you know, rightly so, really enthusiastic about capturing the bombers of finding them, but that created a lot of noise in the kind of monitoring and scanning process, and there were a lot of false identification. It caused a lot of chaos and harm that, you know, otherwise wouldn't have happened. When we're thinking about these systems, we need to make sure that we have mechanisms in place that can help us filter out true signals from the noise and also biases that we may have. Now, you'll see this with machine learning as well. We build these systems with the thought that they're going to not share our biases, but of course, we're training them on the data sets that already encode our biases. So the machines that we build end up, you know, having those biases. I think the same thing could happen with our surveillance systems. So we have to think very carefully and sort of take active measures to make sure that, yeah, we're correcting against these biases and also the noise. So it's very easy to see a signal when it's not.
Absolutely. So we actually have at the moment all the tools for performing surveillance, but then it's almost as if we are kind of lacking a mindset. How do we distinguish or understand our biases? How do we distinguish the noise from the kind of real information? And this is particularly what I kind of wanted to explore with you next, because you have all this kind of widely available technology. We have mobile phones with sensors, cheap cameras, a lot of smart devices that can become kind of our tools for enacting surveillance. But I want to bring back the concept of awareness. What is lacking in our awareness to become effective watchers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Like, some of the cases that I've been involved in, they often involve the people who are watching to not even be aware of what they're watching. And it's very useful information nonetheless. So for example, in one project I was involved in about 10 years ago, we were helping a government track and contain disease outbreaks, in particular those relating to agriculture. And so something that happens with agriculture is that when fish get sick and a large population of them, they wash up on shore. And so you get lots of dead fish on the beach. And so the analysts know this and they're looking for signals, but regular people pretty much don't know that. So when there's a family on vacation on some island and they come across millions of dead fish on the beach, they might see that as a particular kind of sign, the end times, or see this as an opportunity to make a joke about the end times. And so they take a photo of it, tweet it, right, put it up on Twitter, with no idea that there's a system collecting exactly like photographs exactly like that to map where all the fish kills are happening. And there's lots of things like this happening all the time. Like when people like to tweet or Facebook about being sick. So they'll write cough, cough, I'm at home all day. Right. And so there are systems that are watching for signals like that. The surveillance is happening without the intention of the people who are actually doing it.
It's for me, particularly this point is really fascinating because it gets into algorithmically mediated surveillance so mm-hmm. that a lot of the times you don't even know the intention or what we're being surveyed against. Yeah, I think our changing our mentality as watchers is a really interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah. So I'd like to juxtapose this example with another example, which is if I encounter a camera that's pointed at me on the street and the camera is not connected in this example. So what then happens is the inverse of what you just described, Aiden, in the sense that I become aware of a surveillance that's actually not existent. So it's almost like the two are complementary in a way. The idea of collecting data or surveying without the subject being aware, or it's the awareness of the subject, regardless of whether there's data being collected or not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like with audits as well. The threat of an audit can encourage people to obey the tax laws, even if they never get audited, just having that signal being sent to them. The thing I was interested in was also, I think there's an interesting classes of cases where we should be thinking about ways to get people to be active in surveillance. For example, like a lot of ecosystems now have invasive species and people love going on hikes through nature. And there are apps out there that allow you to record invasive species in a local ecosystem. And so like it would be really good to have lots of people out there taking photos of all these invasive species as they're going on their hikes and uploading it to some system so then we can map these things and figure out where to intervene. But a lot of people don't know about the apps or that this would be a good idea to do. And yet it'd be very, like they're going around taking photos often when they're on the hikes anyway. So being able to share that and kind of being more active in that kind of surveillance would be, it'd be really cool if we could figure out ways to encourage people to do that and make them aware that there's in place.
Oh, great. So you are actually kind of advocating for also relating it back to awareness of who is watching, what is being watched, and kind of the afterlife. Because sometimes you perform an action for a specific intention, but then later on it gets flagged on by, let's say, an automated system and becomes part of a surveillance process you weren't even aware of. And again, yeah. Stefan's example about being aware of non-existent surveillance. And I often see kind of behavioral change that occurs based on your knowledge of being surveilled. So actually, if you put a camera in a space, the space itself changes mainly because of that awareness. And I've seen a few cases also like within when it comes to police and people kind of monitoring the police, that the police films back, that you have a police yeah. officer who kind of goes like, all right, let's make this bi-directional. And it's quite interesting for me. But you mentioned one particular point that I want to dig deeper into, and that is the wisdom of the crowds. Because if you have a lot of people surveying, a lot of people collecting kind of data, a lot of people watching, especially when it's bottom up and there's no centrality to their stories, a lot of the times their stories could be conflicting. You could have a lot of noise and a lot of pollution. How do we deal with this kind of dilemma when surveillance becomes bottom up and the tools for surveillance?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's no easy answer, obviously. What comes to mind immediately are there's sort of two main ways of approaching. One is you can build a centralized system that sits on top of the bottom-up inputs. So some of the systems I was just talking about are like this. So there's a machine searching for photographs of dead fish on the beach, right? And so people may take a photo of a bunch of leaves. It's not actually dead fish, right? And so the system can handle that sort of thing because it's designed to it. It's aware of those kinds of sources of noise. But then I think where it gets really interesting is when the system kind of develops organically. So in the early days, Wikipedia was like, right? It's just a lot of bottom-up contributions to the centralized system. Like more of them are going to pop up. And what can we do to kind of guide these future systems that are rising organically? I think it's a really important question, but one that it's hard to know what the answers are, except for like educating people generally about these issues, making them aware of that.
Absolutely. I think there is much deeper and longer conversation about governance and moderation of those bottom-up surveillance systems, because although I think it's a good idea to have like a centralized node that is concerned with kind of, you know, classifying out the noise, even from the example of Wikipedia, not a lot of people know so much about how conflict is handled in Wikipedia. For what are those governance practices? So is there any kind of framework we can adopt to kind of summon better the wisdom of the crowds? Is there like a few general rules maybe we adopt in this case?
Yeah, it's been a while since I looked at the Wikipedia one issue, but at least as a few years ago, I remember there were bots crawling Wikipedia and they're kind of fighting each other over edits. So you can have these automated systems that are kind of competing against each other. You see this with prediction markets too, by the way. You can improve the efficiency of a prediction market by having a bot automatically trade against the human traders. I mean, one general principle that I think would be pretty good to implement when we can is having these things run over the long term so that people can build up trust and reputation profiles, right? So it's, you see this with the, I don't know if you guys pay attention to the like Apple tech rumors. This is one of my guilty pleasures, is just like kind of watching what's going to happen, what product Apple's going to release next. And there are all these people on Twitter who are like, somehow they've got the inside knowledge about the latest product development. And then people built these other websites that are tracking the accuracy of all these product forecasts. And then there are other systems that then aggregate all the tweets together and weight them by the expertise, reputation of all the tweeters. And so now you can get a more reliable forecast of what's going to come out. So having those sorts of things in place where the system lasts long enough so that there are individuals across time building up some kind of track record that you can watch and then use that to inform the decisions you make in the future. That's generally a good thing, although you need to make sure that you have the kind of domain of expertise defined well. So this is a common problem. Someone builds up a track record in one particular domain. Everyone starts trusting them, but then the scope of that domain changes slightly. It gets broader or it moves focus a little bit. And everyone thinks the person is trustworthy, but they no longer are because they've now moved beyond the original.
I think it's quite fascinating from your earlier point about introducing non-human actors to kind of change the dynamic of surveillance, to actually thinking of surveillance and surveillance as a design problem. I think part of it is just kind of understanding what is the context and what kind of interactions does the system warrant between those surveying and those being surveyed, especially when it comes to forecasting and the idea of measuring expertise. And trust in particular, I think, is a really, really important piece of the puzzle. Because how can we foster a better sense of trust with the surveillance system that we're kind of partaking in? So because I think we have control, if I'm filming something with my camera, I have control of the story that is being portrayed. But once it gets into a bigger system that is automated, that has non-human actors, that has some sort of regime of classification, I'm no longer in control. So how do we retain that trust that I had, that kind of my story will be well presented in the bigger system?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't thought too much about this. I mean, one idea that pops to mind is using NFTs or blockchain. Part of the worry, right, is that if you film something and then it gets kind of sliced and diced when it's part of the larger system and it's no longer what you recorded, but your name or your profile is still attached to that information somehow. Yeah, maybe using these new blockchain technologies is a way to help protect that, right?
No, absolutely. So I think actually just safeguarding the integrity of the information and the information transfer then becomes a kind of key to building trust in this case. I just want to ask Stefan if he has anything to add to kind of the issue of trust in this kind of utopian world building exercise.
Well, I love the example of Wikipedia as an example of the wisdom of the crowds and how it emerges. And also we can study, of course, these mechanisms. It's almost like Wikipedia, not as an organization, but as a whole, is somehow learning what mechanisms help it to function as a wisdom of the crowds platform. But I think the challenge when it comes to surveillance might be a little bit different, maybe even a little bit more complex. So this is the challenge that I want to ask Aidan. What would a platform that has not a wisdom of the crowds, but an awareness of the crowds look like? Because of course, in Wikipedia, we're talking about wisdom. But when it comes to surveillance, can we have a crowd that is aware of, in this case, being watched? But ultimately, of course, it can be anything.
Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by a crowd being aware? Because...
Well, let me put it this way. So earlier on, we mentioned two types of surveillance, or maybe two complementary aspects of surveillance, right? So the one being involves the system actually watching and gathering data. And the other was the being aware of camera or being aware of being surveyed, regardless whether it's actually occurring or not. I think the Wikipedia example is more related to the first type, gathering information. I think the awareness of the crowd that I'm sort of hinting at, and don't get me wrong, I don't have any answer to this challenge myself. I just want to put this challenge out there. Well, maybe we can play a little game that I think illustrates it. So let's write a story together with the three of us, and we'll do it word by word. So I'll say the first word. And then Aiden, if you can say the second, and Abdo, you can say the third, and I'll take the fourth again. Okay? So we'll do a sentence together. So I'll start. We
went
further
than
anyone
has
ever
gone.
Right. Let's keep it short. I think that this illustrates the idea. So whose sentence was it? Who was aware of the sentence while saying it? It's a bit indirect maybe, but this is what I mean with sort of awareness of the crowd.
Yeah, so there was part of what's going on there was that I was aware of not wanting to mess up the sentence. I could have easily said a word that would make it ungrammatical, right? So I think there is a similarity here with the Wikipedia example, because there is a version where you can make anonymous contributions or you can make contributions with your... And so when you've got some reputation or some skin in the game, you're now contributing to the system that is gathering the information. That's the first kind of form of surveillance we're talking about. But if you're doing it now where your reputation is involved in the system as well, so people are going to watch you and like they're going to see what inputs you put in there, I think that's going to change your behavior and the quality of the input.
Yeah, so the skin in the game, I think, yeah, that's... I think it revolves back to trust in some sense, or in this case, the...
Yeah, I think this is quite interesting because we've kind of uncovered kind of another aspect of surveillance, but then your almost reputation is basically you're being surveyed by your peer. Yeah. Is that you care about your relationship to your peer. So if you're held accountable, and somehow you would hope that the full sum adds up to the sum of the parts, because everyone has done their part, held accountable, and partly this is the same model that blockchain runs on, that everyone has done their part, and then the sum is therefore reliable. When Stefan asked the question, I also thought about materializing the whole relationship between when am I being surveyed and in what. The same notion in AI, for example, of making a system that is autonomous and that is automated explainable. So surveillance often happens, or we have this idea of it being kind of this sneaky, oh, there's a camera somewhere. I don't know if it's turned on or not. I don't know what it's looking at. And this also creates interesting phenomena like the panopticon effect. Are there ways or are there models or examples of unveiling the secrecy of surveillance or making that relationship visible and that people are aware of it?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's another black box, right? So as you're mentioning, the problem with AI, you've got this black box effect. But if you've got this very complicated system where you're combining surveillance and sous-surveillance, the sous-surveillance is the bottom-up inputs, and then surveillance is also tracking the reputations of the individuals, and then somehow it's all being aggregated and spitting out a result. For low stakes, it may not matter that much, but when the outputs are high stakes and we've got big decisions to make, everyone's going to want to know, like, what's the reason for this output? And if you can't disentangle all those relationships in any meaningful way, then it's effectively a black box. You have this trust issue again. How can we know that the system is functioning well in this?
It's really as if we can transfer some of the insights from the conversation about black boxed algorithm into surveillance-based system. And actually, one of my kind of last questions in this case is about something you already touched on, right? It's you have two vectors of shared accountability, sous-surveillance and surveillance. Both have to do their part. Both have to be kind of explainable, transparent. The integrity of the information has to be in order. Is it really possible to have a framework or perhaps a social contract to ensure the harmony of both surveillance and sous-surveillance, so that there is some bidirectional process that is actually productive? Can we reach what we can call like an equilibrium of knowing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, part of the problem is that we're sometimes struggling with is that the borders between these systems, being inside the system and outside, is blurry, right? So the examples I gave earlier with the people like taking a photo of the fish, they don't know that they're being surveyed, right? And so maybe what we need to do is be more careful about like defining these systems so people know when they're participating in them and when not, and what the conditions are for participation. And having incentives as well, like, and it could create these kind of contracts that incentivize the sort of behavior that we want to see in such a
situation. No, absolutely. So it's really just about, or not just about, I think it's a big task, kind of making transparent motivators behind the surveillance. So why are people surveilling from either side? And also the mechanism occurs. Stefan, do you have kind of further question to add?
Well, so far, both the concept of surveillance and surveillance have been presented as though transparency is the objective. And I think you could also argue that intransparency is actually the mechanism through which surveillance can work. So in case you don't have the resources to monitor everything, and I think AI presents, as a new technology, presents some interesting opportunities there, but suppose you don't have that, then actually you can use intransparency as a tool. To, in the famous Panopticon example, the fact that the prisoners don't know that the guard is watching them or not, that actually creates the power relation itself. Because as a prisoner, if you know you're not being watched, then you don't have to modify your behavior. So I don't think transparency is necessarily the goal here. Maybe it's about two intransparent systems being in equilibrium with each other.
Absolutely. And, so and is there space for intransparency in a utopian system?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think, well, what we're doing now, and I'm really enjoying this exercise, is at least learning about the possible mechanisms and trying to understand them. And we can see how they map onto examples and systems that we know. And through that, we can have a better understanding of not necessarily utopian directly, but at least systems that that we want. And I think that that makes this a good exercise to these motions and define the terms and see how they relate to each other.
I'm just picking up on that. One way that you sometimes get that inverse effect is when people don't want to make a decision because they wouldn't want to see it reported in the newspaper the next day, right? So even though the media is not watching, the decision's still geared towards a particular direction because that concern. And so maybe there's, with the proliferation of all these smart devices, there's a way in which we're going to, I mean, we already are changing the media landscape, but maybe in this way, we might be changing it and creating more of this inverse effect. So in the past, you didn't know some big media organization was watching you, so you do the right thing. Now you don't know if someone's got a camera nearby or you know, trying to blog about your organization's activities or something. Or you have someone on the inside who's gonna tweet about the decision that you make. And so having that kind of more, effectively more sources of media, a more kind of distributed media, you might get more of these inverse effects.
Yeah, I think this is maybe stepping back into problem space a little bit, where I think it's the conversation that really would fascinates me is how can we take the problem from the conversation from a problem space and kind of shift it over to solution space. Like you said, I think part of it is that there are a lot of systems that are doing the surveillance. And if I navigate the web, I don't know exactly who's surveilling me and at what point and how these systems are interacting with each other or maybe sharing information or sharing the task of surveillance. Can the same process or the same doubts be useful?
Yeah, this is, I think Stefan's point is a good one where you may not actually being, what's the term, surveilled, I guess, but the mere fact that you might be is going to change your behavior.
So yeah, in that sense, that's fascinating. A fascinating aspect about surveillance in general is that it prevents something from happening. The way we like to think about causal efficacy is that you do something and then something else happens. And in this case, because you have a mechanism or because you have an AI or you survey, you prevent something from happening. So this is also maybe how it could fit into this more utopian view, because I think we have a dire need for systems that prevent stuff from happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an interesting point of the same kind of secrecy or black box that keeps power functioning can be used to hold power accountable through kind of this black box surveillance. And I think it's really a fascinating premise worth exploring. Yeah, at the moment, yeah, I don't have more questions, but I just want to ask Aydin if there's any kind of part of the conversation you'd like to delve deeper into, or if you have any remarks about utopian trajectory that we want to adopt.
Yeah, so one idea I've been thinking about, it kind of flips everything we just said around. It's about trying to encourage things to happen and them being positive things. So, and it's also connected to the media. So as we all know, like, our media is very much attracted to the bad things that are happening in the world. But with this, the possibility of surveillance, we may also have the possibility to change our media in a way such that more of the good things that are happening get reported which then in turn encourages more good things to happen. A friend of mine had this website running called, it was called something like Acts of Kindness, where people would go around and they would do a random act of kindness and they'd film it and then post it online. So everyone could see these random acts of kindness from around the world. And of course, it just becomes this viral thing and it encourages everyone to be more and more kind with each other. So since we're thinking about this in a utopian perspective, I think there's something interesting there as well to kind of, yeah, think about how we can build these systems to create like new positive things happening, obviously already happening, but like we could amplify.
No, I think it's really interesting that we can almost repurpose the designs of the surveillance systems into something that is kind of more utopian. We already talked about awareness, trust, transparency, automated systems, non-human actors, and accountability. Also, reputation as building blocks of the design of surveillance systems or surveillance trajectories. And I think with this, roughly, we can kind of conclude our conversation. I would like to thank Aydin, but before I fully kind of wrap this up, I would maybe like to ask you about some recommendations that you have for perhaps further reading or that an interesting resource that touches on the topic. You've already mentioned the Act of Kindness website, but I'm actually relying on your generosity here.
So one book that comes to mind immediately is, it's called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay. It was documenting all the ways in which groups of people can behave irrationally. And that's actually where the term the wisdom of crowds comes from. So it's good to read that so we keep in mind this kind of dual nature of crowds.
I think you're also being extremely humble by not mentioning your own book. And I think that will be a loss for the listeners.
Thanks for that, Stefan. Yeah, so the book is called Psychedelic Experience. It should be coming out later this year, probably around September, October. If you're interested in it, you can go to my website, aydinlyon.com. And the basic idea is that, as I think a lot of us may know, that the psychedelics research has been kind of under full swing for the last decade or so. And we're getting really, really exciting results from this research. Psychedelics are treating a range of ailments from depression to end of life, anxiety to addiction to other drugs and so on. And people often report that these experiences are one of the most profound and meaningful experiences of their entire life. And so the goal of the book is basically it starts off with a simple question, which is, what are these experiences? These experiences are so powerful and so profound, and they're so different from our normal everyday experiences. What are they? And then starting from that question explores different kinds of answers that we might give. And one kind of popular answer that's been around for a while is that these are mind-revealing experiences. And the idea there is that we're walking around in our normal lives with most of our minds or large portions of our minds kind of hidden from our awareness. An easy example of this is that it's fairly easy for you to remember what you had for breakfast this morning, but like much more difficult to remember an event that happened to you last year, right? So the distant memories tend to be more buried in the mind than more recent. And so something that we see in these psychedelic sessions is that people's memories, often from early childhood, come out in the experience. And so this is an example of a part of the mind being revealed, an early childhood memory that's kind of locked away and it comes out. And so one thing I discuss in the book is, what are the different ways we can have these experiences? And can we have better or worse ways of having them? So you may not, as we know, psychedelics also cause hallucinations. People can have delusional beliefs as well. There's like a lot of noise that can come along with the experience. And so while these psychedelic substances are like a kind of really powerful way of revealing the mind, there are other ways that might kind of have complementary effects. So one of the methods that I discuss is the practice of meditation. One analogy I like is psychedelics are a bit like going to an archaeological dig site and using dynamite to blow the whole thing up. You uncover everything that's there, but it kind of gets messed up a little bit in the process. And in contrast, meditation is like slowly dusting away, very carefully, like just grinding away and uncovering things. And so you preserve the thing that you're uncovering, but it's really slow and time consuming, and you may give up as well. So having these kind of tools in place are really, they're really useful for helping us to understand our own minds and for personal growth. That's the gist of the book.
So now I have two books on my reading list. I really, really would like to thank you, Aydin, for this. I think we have explored multiple great directions going forward. I, again, would like to thank you, Aydin, and I would like to thank Stefan from the Asimov Institute and Sabine Winters from the Future-Based Organization for making this conversation possible through their collaboration. Thank you all so much for being here today, and we'll see you all soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's been really enjoyable.
Thank you.
For more information, links and show notes, visit futurebased.org.